At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, in no particular order, Batman as an economic cautionary tale, housing as, well, as the same thing, and a new book from Dave Eggers from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 18th of July. Glad to have you with us, and gladder still to at long last be able to deliver some good housing news. Home builders are feeling pretty good about things, which is a distinct change of direction for their mood. We learned this morning builders broke ground on more homes last month than they have in any month since 2008. However, comma, and don't tell me you didn't know this was coming, when you fall as far as the U.S. housing market has fallen, you're climbing out of a very deep hole. Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji gets us going today.
Stephen Paul is the executive vice president of Mid-Atlantic Builders. He says things have been looking up for his company since March.
Probably the best 4 months of sales that we've seen in several years.
But Paul's quick to point out that business has been so miserable for so long, it's difficult to feel better.
It's sort of like when you've been sick or you have a really bad headache and slowly it goes away and then you suddenly realize, oh, I don't have a headache anymore.
He thinks the housing crisis headache is going away. He's even hired a couple of college grads to prepare for a boom next spring.
Shireen, this is good news. Indeed, housing is coming back.
That's Stuart Gabriel. He's the director of UCLA's Ziman Center for Real Estate.
But please bear in mind that this so-called recovery to housing is muted and it's late.
Late because housing is usually the first thing to bounce back after an economic slump. Muted because we need twice as much new construction than we're seeing now to get back to a normal housing market. Not the out-of-whack market we saw during the bubble where 2 million new homes were built each year, but a normal one, around 1.5 million new homes. Robert Van Oort is a professor of real estate and economics at George Washington University. He's surprised the housing start numbers aren't higher. Van Oort blames banks for not lending enough to future homebuyers and says Americans are still worried about where the economy's headed.
Buying a house is a bet on the future. And when people are uncertain of the future, they're reluctant to. So we have a better market than we had a month ago, a significantly better market than we had a year ago. But we still don't have a very good market.
For Marketplace, I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji.
If tonight's agenda for the city council meeting in San Bernardino, California, is to be believed, it's going to become someday soon the third city in this state to file for bankruptcy protection. Marketplace's Adrian Hill drove out there the other day to get a sense of the city and its problems.
This is a story of shifting fortunes, of being on the right side and then on the wrong side of change. And we'll start it here.
Dick and Mac McDonald opened the world's first McDonald's self-service drive-in restaurant on this site in San Bernardino, California, December 1948.
Albert Okura reads from a plaque. He runs the office of his fast food chain, Juan Pollo, here. He's also set up an unofficial McDonald's museum, anchored by remnants of the original restaurant, some pavers, some of the original sign.
Kind of looks like it, but it's not an exact replica.
This is a relic of success, which can be what San Bernardino feels like. Richard Thompson is a local historian. He pulls out a newspaper from the 1920s, which called San Bernardino the payroll city.
Everybody had a job. Everybody was busy working.
Rail built this town. The auto, Route 66, kept it going. But over the decades, good-paying jobs left. Today, the unemployment rate is near 16%. The housing bubble burst, property values collapsed, tattered lease signs hang off tattered buildings.
Do you think San Bernardino is ever going to be the payroll city again?
No. No, it's, no.
Why not?
It hasn't got anything going for it.
But Wayne Austin hasn't given up hope. He lives here and heads the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
I have strong faith here because I know that we still have many good-hearted people that really love and want to get involved in City San Bernardino.
Sure, he says. It'll be painful. San Bernardino's lost its tax base, but still has high expenses for services like police and fire. It can't afford to spend like the city it used to be. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street were spending today. All three major indices finished in positive territory. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've talked before on the program about some of the changes that the huge pile of student debt out there is bringing to this country, how young people are living with their parents longer, they're putting off marriage, doing all sorts of things. But some data out this week from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York caught our eye. It said the people struggling the most to pay off their student loans aren't fresh-faced new graduates. They're practically old, as in their 40s. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott has that story.
The New York Fed says 40-somethings have a higher student loan delinquency rate than any other age group, almost 12%, compared to just under 9% overall. Deanne Lunan with the National Consumer Law Center says many who fall behind were non-traditional students.
In general, they were older when they started school in the first place. A lot of them actually have their own dependents when they went to school. They have a very low completion rate as well. And all of those are also, unfortunately, risk factors for delinquency and default.
The economy, of course, has made things worse. Tamara Drought is with the nonprofit think tank Demos. She says in many ways, the recession has hit middle-aged people hardest.
People in their 40s lost a lot of coping mechanisms that enabled them to pay the bills. They lost equity in their home. They lost value in their 401k. And they're also a little bit more likely to be among the ranks of the long-term unemployed.
Even for those who pay on time, student loans are a drain. Drought, who's 41, is still paying off the $68,000 she borrowed for grad school.
The money that is going to paying off my student loan debt certainly isn't going into a college savings fund for my daughter. Could I be putting more away for retirement security? Absolutely.
Most economists still agree going to college pays off in better jobs and higher pay. But as older borrowers are finding out, it can be a very long-term investment. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Author Dave Eggers has a new book out. It's called A Hologram for the King. It's about an American businessman named Alan Clay and how his career working for a bicycle company kind of mirrors the rise and fall of American manufacturing, outsourcing, and all. Dave Eggers, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
This guy, Alan Clay, he's 54-something years old. He is down on his luck having ridden no pun intended, actually, having ridden the Schwinn Bicycle Company to some professional success. And then when that company faltered, so did he. What got you to Schwinn Bicycles?
Well, I grew up a little north of Chicago. And, you know, the Schwinn Bicycle Company was based on the west side of Chicago for almost 100 years. And they, you know, made millions of bikes right there. And they were
I had one. Mine was red with a banana seat and a sissy bar.
Yeah. Well, they were really well-built bikes, yeah. And they were built like tanks. They would last for decades. And the idea was that they, you know, they were built to, that was, this is your one bike, or you can pass it along to your sibling and your children and grandchildren, and it'll still run. And they, you know, they really made a good product. And then, you know, in the 80s, they started shopping out some of the parts and some of the, you know, more and more of the bicycle to Taiwan first and then China. And pretty soon these bike makers in China didn't need Schwinn anymore. Step by step, they sort of did a lot of different things wrong.
When you first started doing your character sketches for Alan Clay and everybody else in this book, was it purposeful that you hooked it all on American manufacturing and industrialism and sort of the rise and fall of it?
Yeah, I think that that interested me first. It started with Schwinn and bikes, and you know, I guess I'm a publisher, so we create our books, and you know, we manufacture our books mostly in the U.S. now, but we experimented and still do here and there with books made in China, and so it was on my mind. Sort of the difference in unit cost and, you know, the advantages of shipping things over there.
Well, it's so interesting you mention your own experience because, first of all, you're a book publisher in an economy that is moving toward electronic books, which must just kill you somehow. But right? I mean, but here's the other thing. This book, I mean, I'm holding it in my hand. It is it's beautiful, right? The cover is ornate. It's heavy. It's I don't know if it's carved or precision drilled or whatever it is. But here's the thing. I'm a big one for reading the dedication page and then that page opposite it. And way down at the bottom, it says first printing, manufactured at Thompson Shore Printers, Dexter, Michigan.
Yeah, there is a medium-sized printer right outside Detroit. And so they were on my radar just for this nice local printer. And this was done at a totally regular unit cost, competitive with anything else
really?
You make in the U.S.
Because I got to tell you, it looks really expensive.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really
but
does.
That's if you work within the strengths of the printer or any sort of, you know, manufacturer. If you could work with what you're envisioning and make it work with the machinery they've got, you can come up with something great. You just have to be creative. And it was a weird thing that while I was writing about this, we were sort of going through the same decision process that Alan went through years ago, which is like a lot of the outsourcing of this manufacturing, it's done by little, you know, 1,000 cuts. And before you know it, you're shopping out everything and all this knowledge base is gone and, you know, and then the supply chain is gone. And but, you know, I think that the advantage is to be able to call somebody on the phone, visit the plant very easily, you know, turn things around quickly. You know, it makes a lot of sense.
The book by Dave Eggers is called A Hologram for the King. We will have an excerpt on our website and, I should say, a picture of that cover. You sort of have to check it out to know what we're talking about. Dave Eggers, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
If you're among the fantasy faithful who are going to go see the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises, when it opens this weekend, you could go about it two ways, probably. You could just enjoy it as a darkly entertaining superhero movie, or you could give some thought to the deeper themes. We, naturally, are intrigued by the economic subtext because, remember, Bruce Wayne is a one percenter. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has this spoiler-free story.
The movie is loaded with the mandatory explosions, fights, Batman biceps, Catwoman curves, but Wall Street Journal film critic Joe Morgenstern says an economic inequality theme is there too, right from the outset.
It's the one powerful speech in the film. Anne Hathaway as Catwoman, or Selina Kyle, whispering into Bruce Wayne's ear, there's a storm
coming, Mr. Wayne. You and your friends better batten down the hatches, because when it hits, you're all going to wonder how you ever thought you could live so large and leave so little for the rest of us.
There's also the attack on Gotham's stock exchange by the villain Bane and his thugs. Pundits are musing about the movie's point of view, but finding the film's politics isn't easy, Morgenstern says.
The movie is a Rorschach test. It's so expert in handling the themes that are in the air and in the culture without committing to any program about them.
The last Batman film pulled off a similar trick, handling post-9/11 themes of wiretapping and torture. Hollywood Reporter staff editor Jordan Zacharin says people on the right and left will see the Batman they want.
You can see someone who's doing extraordinary things to fight terrorism, or you can look at it as somebody who is a rich guy who's very charitable and a sort of big money donor to the Democratic Party if you want to go that far.
Not everyone's going that far. I talked to the manager of a comic book store a block from Zuccotti Park, birthplace of Occupy Wall Street. He wasn't thinking about economics. He just hopes this movie's as awesome as the last. Decide for yourself, Friday. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, summer vacation just ain't what it used to be.
Oh, I never get away from the office. Even though I'm taking my vacation days, I'm always looking through my email and making phone calls.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, looky here, everybody. A second straight day of gains powered by companies that make things for the global economy. The Dow Industrials added 103 points, 0.8%, 12,908 the number. The NASDAQ up 32 points, 1.1%, 2942 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, 2/3%, finished at 1372. You may have a Honeywell thermostat on your wall at home, but the company also makes airplane controls and parts, and it was that aerospace division selling more parts to Boeing, Airbus, and some other aircraft builders that fueled better-than-expected earnings. Honeywell shares up nearly 7% today. Madison Square Garden posted a 1% loss after confirming its diamond in the rough. Jeremy Lin is indeed leaving the Knicks for the Houston Rockets. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee discusses strategies to make college affordable. And presidential elections take place in India. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is, as you know, an increasingly digital society. Private companies getting involved in every aspect of our lives. Which gets us to this next item. The state of Washington is working with Microsoft and Facebook to help people register to vote through Facebook. We saw that and we figured we had to know more. So we called up Shane Hamlin. He's the co-director of elections up in Washington State to make sure we saw that story right. Shane, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So how is this going to work? You go to Facebook and you like the government of the state of Washington and then you're in there?
Well, that's very close, actually. So if you're on Facebook and you find our state, our elections, Washington State Elections Facebook page, the app is there and you can access it. Or if a friend has already used it and they like it or recommend it, you'll will see it that way. Once you activate the app and you click on it, you're giving permission to use some of your profile information to begin the process.
Facebook has had its more than its share, really, of privacy issues, right? Did you guys do a little pause before you entered into this thing? Because you can see voters going, wait, Facebook and my data?
Because of the way the application works is you're not entering your information into Facebook. They're not collecting it. It's coming directly to us. So it's not that you're registering with Facebook and then they're giving us the information. They're not conducting the voter registration. You are, and you're doing it with our system, but you just accessed it via Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Ultimate goal here, I imagine, is to get more people registered to vote.
That is the ultimate goal. Yeah. I mean, that is why we are doing this. That is why we have online registration.
Now, I have to tell you, I mean, I'm as in favor of more participation in this democracy as anybody. But can you see an objection that goes like this? We are getting now private companies engaged in the fundamental mechanism of democracy.
What you just described has already been happening. It's already been occurring for a long time in just in different ways, whether private companies are funding voter registration drives. This is a very transparent way, by the way, in which that's happening as opposed to some other ways in which companies may be funding voter registration or get out the vote activities. With the advent of technology and online registration, the perception of it is or the visibility of it is maybe higher because we are all very attuned to technology issues. And Facebook obviously is a high-profile company and it's going to attract a lot of attention.
Can you see a day where I can sit in the safety of my own home and go to a Facebook page and vote?
Well, no, not on Facebook. Not on Facebook. Voting online is something that, you know, it's something that's been a topic of conversation for a number of years now. you know, a number of important security issues have to be overcome. But we also feel like, and our secretary has been very vocal on this, that if you don't continue to have this conversation, if you don't continue to push smart people to try to solve these problems, we won't get there, when actually there's an expectation at some point we will get there, because the generations that are growing up now and the younger generations are going to expect to be able to do that, and they're going to want to know why their government can't make that happen.
Mm. Shane, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
There's news today of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, its first enforcement action, a $210 million fine against Capital One for tricking people into buying financial products they didn't necessarily need. Also, earlier this week, the CFPB started regulating credit rating agencies, including the dozens of consumer credit bureaus out there. Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion are the ones we've all heard of. They keep files on the finances of 200 million-plus Americans. And they issue 3 billion credit reports every single year. You can't really get anywhere in this economy without credit. So on this installment of Money Matters, our regular look at the news of the day and what it means for our bottom lines, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more now on the CFPB, credit, and us.
The all-important credit score is how lenders determine the interest you pay on a loan and whether you get the money at all. A score in the mid to high 700s is brilliant. Below 620 or so, bad news. Jamie April teaches classics at the University of Texas, Austin. She scores around 700.
I'm pretty proud that I've managed to keep it reasonably high.
April just bought a first home with her husband. Dealing with the credit agencies has been confusing.
There have been times when different agencies would have really different scores for us.
April's husband's report used to be tainted by some unfortunate run-ins with creditors.
Thankfully, they've all fallen off now because the whole 7 years thing has cycled through. But even after those things had passed, he had a 250-point difference between one agency and another. And he had to call the very, very low-score agency, I think probably 5 or 6 times.
April says she doesn't have a clue how the companies come up with a credit score. Bill Sermons at the Center for Responsible Lending says no one does. It's proprietary.
It's really just a black box. Studies have shown up to 40% of reports have errors in them.
The credit agency has to let you dispute any information you think is wrong.
But the process is automated, and people feel that sometimes the responses they get don't match up with the complaint that they made. The CFPB has signaled they are going to address the dispute resolution process, the fact that it sort of puts all the burden on the consumer to deal with inaccuracies.
Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling says consumers also need to get on the ball.
In spite of it being free of charge, 62% of consumers reported that they had not ordered a copy of their credit report in the last 12 months. Shame on them.
Shame on me. I pay the bank $10 a month to pull my credit reports that I could be getting for free. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you've got a consumer finance question about your credit or gas prices, bank fees, anything else that strikes you, we want to hear about it. Go to marketplace.org and click on Money Matters. Here we are, mid-July, the very heart of summer, a time best spent, by most accounts, in a cabin by the lake, playing on the beach or up in the mountains, getting away from it all. Summer, though, may be losing its hold on our leisure. Lingering economic anxiety paired with changing calendars for work and school, as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
The Santa Monica Pier is instant summer. Sun, sand, a roller coaster, and tourists like...
I'm Alan Carruthers from Greenville, South Carolina.
Wife, Julie.
Son, Caleb, 15.
The Carruthers embody what you might conjure from summer vacation, a family in shorts and t-shirts traveling together. Alan, the dad, says it's not hard for him to get time off work. Like many households, his son's schedule dictates vacation.
Oh, most definitely. He plays travel basketball, so we don't travel any during school year, and we don't travel any first part of the summer because of sports.
And then I had a mission trip, went to Allendale, South Carolina, with my church, so...
So they have this 1 week together in California before school starts in August, with a bit of a recession twist. The family is visiting their daughter, who's recently out of college and hasn't had luck finding work. In fact, a job interview kept her away from family beach day. The unemployment rate weighs on vacation plans even for people with jobs. As companies plow ahead with minimal staff, workers feel less free to take off. Human resources expert Steve Kane says they also want to be indispensable.
Well, at least seem indispensable, yes.
If you leave for 2 weeks and the office stays the same,
there is a sense that if the world can continue without one's input, maybe your input isn't that significant.
That need to be needed fuels another trend, the workcation.
Oh, I never get away from the office, even though I'm taking my vacation days. I'm always looking through my email and making phone calls.
Vivian Panu is a local I met on the Santa Monica Pier. She just got back from a trip to Chicago. A few days of work, downtime with her two kids in between. That saves some money, too.
Because I was able to cover one of the tickets as a company expense. The other ticket I was able to pay for with miles. And then I only had to come up with another $620 for the third ticket, which is an insane price.
That's why people not beholden to school schedules may avoid travel during official summer break.
You can save 50% by going after August 17 or early September. It's still summer.
George Hobica runs airfarewatchdog.com. A poll of his 250,000 Twitter followers showed the majority less interested in summer travel. And it's not just about prices or swarms of kids.
The global weather patterns are definitely having an effect. The most frequent comment was, it's too hot.
Hobica says people are also taking more short trips scattered over the year. That's popular with the growing army of freelancers who don't get paid leave. I met business consultant Molly Lavick on the pier. She's swamped with deadlines, but I caught her during
my staycation for summer 2012.
One day?
One afternoon. It's happening right now. The weather is incredible, and I'm just having the best time.
California knows how to party. Woo! California.
I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, I don't know if you noticed, but we didn't mention Ben Bernanke or his testimony this morning before the House Financial Services Committee at all on the show today. You want to know why? All right, I'll tell you. Here's what he said yesterday to the Senate Banking Committee.
The U.S. economy has continued to recover, but economic activity appears to have decelerated somewhat during the first half of this year.
And here he is today in the House.
The U.S. economy has continued to recover, but economic activity appears to have decelerated somewhat during the first half of the year.
You heard the difference, right? Come on. The first one was totally half a second longer. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. The Dow up 103 points today, 0.8%. I know it's mean to make fun of Ben Bernanke, right? The NASDAQ added 32 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.2%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.